And good morning. Here we are at Wednesday Talk Radio once again. My name's Paul Rowanby, your host for the hour. That was, ironically, strangely, Bob Dylan. For those of you who don't know the history, I won't go into it, but I guess it was written during a Zionist phase of his, apparently. And yeah, that's a defending Israel, which is fine and good and righteous, but the lyrics are very contestable, but we won't get into all that because I have two guests to talk about Israel and Saudi Arabia, two bullies of the Middle East, hence neighborhood bully. My guests are, well, let me just start with my introduction here. While Saudi Arabia wages ruthless war on Yemen and beheads or otherwise dismembers its own dissidents, Israel continues its brutal onslaught of Gaza, suppresses internal dissent, and hounds pro-Palestinian BDS activists around the world. Both get massive military aid from and work closely with the U.S., and especially since 9/11 have been forging closer ties with each other. Recent revelations about some local Jewish federations, so far that we know, including Los Angeles and San Francisco, have been funding the shadowy website Canary Mission, which posts political dossiers and basically persecutes pro-Palestinian activists, mostly students. This revelation has brought long simmering tensions within the Jewish community in the United States more out in the open. And here in Portland this past Sunday, the Middleman Jewish Community Center hosted a Jewish Federation of Greater Portland gala dinner to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the founding of Israel. It featured Ehud Barak, who as defense minister led the Gaza War in 2008 and 9, in which over 1,200 Palestinians were killed and which helped start the spiral of violence in Gaza, which continues to this day. As prime minister, he continued the vast expansion of illegal Israeli settlements on Palestinian land. And of course, if you heard Democracy Now!, you know just the insanely brutal, bizarre goings-on around Saudi Arabia and the killing of the Washington Post columnists. To talk about all this, our guests today are by phone Ariel Gold, National Co-Director of Code Pink, a women-led grassroots organization working to end U.S. wars and militarism, support peace and human rights initiatives, and redirect our tax dollars into healthcare, education, green jobs, and other life-affirming programs. She has been a vocal advocate, activist in the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS movement, to pressure Israel to come into compliance with international law and human rights standards and to stop the siege of Gaza, among other goals. Earlier this year, she was detained and deported by Israel for her pro-BDS stance, and she's done many other public actions, which we'll talk about in the studio. We have her by phone from New York. In the studio, we have Alana Goldman, who recently established a new chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace at Portland State University and studies women's studies and family and child studies.
Child family studies.
Good morning, Alana. Thanks. To you. And good morning, Ariel.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And thank you so much for being here. This is, as you heard, a very intense and auspicious time. Of course, I didn't mention the other bullies that are running rampant, like the Proud Boys. I don't know, here in Portland, that was also featured on Democracy Now! This morning. they are running rampant, and in New York, where you are. And I don't know, I see both of these episodes, the killing of the journalist and the Saudi journalist and the Proud Boys, as being manifestations of Trumpism. But Ariel, first, talk a little bit about Code Pink, how you got involved, a little bit about your own personal background.
Well, I should begin by saying that I am also a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, and a lot of my activism began with leading my local chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace. So I'm thrilled to be on with somebody who just started a chapter.
Yay.
I think it was a couple years ago that my profile came on to Canary Mission, and I have to say, I think this is, you know, unsurprising that but it's coming to light, all this funding of this shadowy website. Funding for repressive policies of Israel are only somewhat hidden by American Jewish groups. So, you know, this is kind of unsurprising in many ways. We at Code Pink, we do a lot of bold action to be out again.
You're breaking up. I don't know if there's a physically a place you can move to that might prevent that from happening.
Let me try to walk around a little bit.
Yeah, that often sometimes helps. You sound better
yes.
there. Sorry, go ahead.
Sure. So, you know, this past year when Israel first announced their blacklist, which includes both Jewish Voice for Peace and Code Pink, as well as a number of other U.S. organizations, our two co-founders, Medea Benjamin and Jody Evans, flew right into the country and did manage to get in. Though when I tried to enter in July, it was quite a bit less successful.
Talk about what happened to you there.
Sure. So the previous year when I had been there, I had spent 6 weeks staying in the West Bank city of Hebron, working on the ground with Palestinians. When I left, Israel informed me that in order to come back, I needed permission from the Israeli government in advance. And so I obtained a student visa from the consulate, in some ways not too different than the story that we're watching unfold right now in Israeli Supreme Court. And I arrived in Tel Aviv, but rather than honoring the visa, which they themselves had given me, I was detained for about 7 hours and questioned extensively, and then deported back to the U.S.
And did they? So obviously, they asked you a lot of political questions. I you know, it was sort of a surprise when that started to happen a lot more in the United States after 9/11. But I guess activists in Israel have been going through sort of a political being. Questioned politically for quite a bit longer, I imagine.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, they didn't ask me anything about boycott, divestment, and sanctions. The majority of their questions and really harassment of me was around why I would have friendships and work relationships with Palestinians. They went through my phone and were furious that there were Arab names in my phone, Arab contacts. They harassed me about what I had done the previous summer in Hebron, that a video I had taken when I was physically assaulted mm-hmm. by a settler
mm-hmm.
and Israeli
night.
Soldiers mm-hmm. stood by and watched had gone viral. And so they screamed at me that I had made Israel look bad, and why had I done that, and why would a Jew have working or other have any relationships with Arabs?
Uh-huh. And well, let's turn to you, Ilana. We'll get back to you, Ariel, in a minute. So talk about a little bit about your personal experience leading to your activism and your founding a new chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace at Portland mm-hmm. State.
First of all, Ariel, I just want to say you're an icon, and I've looked up to you for like 2 years, so it's like an honor to even be kind of meeting you over the phone. But I was in Jerusalem when you were detained over the summer, so I was kind of like seeing that whole thing play out on all these different news articles. Like living there for a month, I was just seeing all these new things come out about what was happening. So it's interesting to hear it from like months later from your perspective. And also I was detained in the airport when I left for 3 hours, but I had gone to the airport early because I kind of figured it would happen, so I had my questions ready. But yeah, they asked me similar things. They asked me who very specific people were. They didn't ask me which organizations I was a part of, which is what they claim to have like blockaded. If you're a part of whatever, Jewish Voice for Peace, or if you support BDS, then you're not allowed entry. But rather, they asked me which specific Palestinians I had stayed with, which specific organizations, Palestinian-led organizations I worked with, which, of course, I didn't give any names because that's violent and dangerous and racist, but I also just think it's ironic how they claim to be like a Jewish state for any Jew who wants to, in the diaspora, who wants to come, you know, see their homeland or whatever, and then if you, you know, oppose a law or a thing they, like, whatever, something about the state of Israel. It could be honestly anything, the government, you're not allowed in or you're detained. So I just think it's ironic. And then basically leading up to this fall, I, sorry, I'm sick, but I guess it started, like, I went on a very propaganda birthright-ish trip when I was 16 because they take you to a bunch of very horrific concentration camps for a week, and they show you Auschwitz and Birkenau, and you walk from Birkenau to Auschwitz with an Israeli flag on your back, and they say, like, look what you have now, with no narrative of Palestinians even existing. And you're 16, and you don't know any other thing. You're raised this way. So it's very one-sided and very propaganda-based. And then they take you to Israel for a week, and they say, go ahead and party. Look what you have. Look, and I think it falls on, like, Israeli Independence Day, too. So that was my first introduction to what the hell is Zionism, what is going on here.
I just want to just interrupt you briefly and remind you to watch the words that you use.
It's so normal for me. I'm so
I know
sorry.
That younger people are not familiar so much with terrestrial radio.
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, so you were talking about an experience, because I blocked out probably about 40 seconds of what you said there.
No worries.
Anyway, so you were mentioning that when you're 16, you did a March of the Living.
Right.
And that's something that's sort of really traditional for young Jews.
Yeah, and it's free, which is another thing with birthright.
So the Jewish state the Israel state pays for
Jewish federations in wherever you live. I'm from Las Vegas. Pay for your trip. So, so that was my first. Yeah, so I went on this free trip when I was 16 in high school, which is even younger than the birthright age, which now is extended to 30. So anyway. And then I moved here for college. I realized how a lot of the social issues I deeply, deeply cared about are all intertwined and connected with each other, like the shooting of Mike Brown. And I remember when Zimmerman wasn't indicted, I was furious, and I was like connecting all these dots of how you know, the IDF trains U.S. police force, and all these things are connected. And I kind of just woke up, and I was like, I can't say I'm an activist and I support all of these social issues that are so important to me and not care about what's going on in Palestine at all. So I did my research. I, for the past years, have been watching documentaries, reading, meeting other anti-Zionist Jews, finding a community, being ostracized from my own community for being an anti-Zionist Jew. And over this past summer, I worked at a school called Hand in Hand in Jerusalem. It's a K-12 Arab-Israeli school that teaches both narratives. They teach about the Nakba. They have both a Palestinian and Israeli teacher in every classroom. And the school itself falls directly half East Jerusalem, half West Jerusalem. The founder of that school is from Portland, which is how I found out about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked there over the summer for a month. I lived there for a month. And that was a very, it made things seem more urgent, and not like they already weren't before, because I've always felt like my heart was there and in it. And like, whether or not I ever visited wasn't relevant, because every human being should care about Palestine. But now it seems like it's just more real to maybe want to go back one day if I'm allowed entry. We'll see. I don't know. But spending time in the West Bank and meeting activists who I had followed on Twitter, who I was friends with on Facebook, who I could now meet and give them a hug. And I'm like, I'm so honored to meet you and know you and hear your stories, and also just to humanize Palestinians and see how they live every day and what they do. And now it made it more urgent to start a chapter when I got back. So.
And so, So that just started. So that just started this fall. The new chapter.
Yeah, it started like I guess a month ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how many members do you have now?
We don't have like an official list yet because our first event is this Friday. We're having an anti-Zionist Shabbat dinner. So after this first event, we'll have sort of like an actual list of people who are interested.
Well, keep us informed here at KBOO. We like to cover local activism.
Thanks.
So did you look up whether you're on the Canary Mission?
I'm not yet, but my close friends of like 10 plus years are. I'm surprised I'm not. I've tweeted at them saying like, delete your account. They infuriate me. Anyway, I will probably have one after this, so I'm sure they know who I am. It's fine.
So Ariel, I don't know if we've even covered this on KBOO yet, this Canary Mission. It's new to me. I'm not Jewish. I don't follow these things intimately. The reason I got into this is, you know, obviously the Saudi Arabia thing. How can you not sit up and pay attention? It's so brazen and out there. But I was at the Middleman Jewish Center on Sunday, where actually I handed one of my signs off to Alana.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people. There was probably at least 75, 80, 100. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a good, no media there covering it, unfortunately. Nice. But talk a little more about this Canary Mission, since it's really just in the past week it's come out about Los Angeles and San Francisco Jewish Federation's funding this. Talk a little bit more about the background of this.
Sure. So Canary Mission has been around for quite a while. It's called kind of a shadow website because until during this past year, when a journalist from The Forward started exposing the funding behind them, there was never any information about who was running this website. But it's been around for maybe a decade. And what it does is it lists profiles of activists that support Palestinian rights, and its main focus is really students. So when I was put on the list, when I was given a profile, it didn't affect my career prospects. You know, in some ways, they kind of listed my resume. Ariel has worked with Jewish, you know, as a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, and she works with Code Pink, and she's done this action and that action. But this is my professional work. What the website has over the years really aimed to do was to profile students, and largely Muslim students, and then they send that list, these profiles, to job fairs and potential employers, and the descriptions read as though you're supporting terrorism. So it's really a bullying scare tactic largely aimed at students. That over the years has had a really destructive force. And then we've been seeing more and more Israel start to use Canary Mission. So the other thing that it does is when you Google somebody's name, that profile can pop up. Now, myself, who's had a lot of media coverage, it's not the top thing that comes up about me. But for other people, it might be the first thing that comes up. And this is, you know, what we're seeing, what we saw with the American student who's currently being detained and still refused entry to Israel. They Googled her name and Canary Mission came up with really what's nothing to be, you know, to begin with, that she was the president of an SJP chapter years ago. But Israel then also uses this as evidence to deny people entry into the country. And so, yeah, over the past year in pieces and now in more specifics, the funding for Canary Mission is being revealed. Now, even the ADL has come out against Canary Mission. Mm-hmm. And the ADL is I think of it as quite a repressive organization. This is an organization that's responsible for a lot of the police exchanges between the U.S. and Israel. And even they have put out tweets saying that Canary Mission is a bullying website and that it should be taken down. I'm trying to remember the timing for when they put that out. But, you know, and this is quite inexcusable that We have funding. Like I said, it's not surprising, but inexcusable that it's been funded by Jewish groups. But the large focus of the website over the years hasn't been the targeting of Jews so much as Muslim students overall.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I downloaded a few articles about this breaking story. This article is from October 15th. It's from the progressive Jewish newspaper Forward. Documents reveal board of shadowy charity linked to Canary Mission. And it talks about a group in Israel which apparently runs it named Megamot Shalom. Do you know anything about them?
I don't know them offhand.
Let me see. Which is controlled largely by English-speaking immigrants to Israel living in Jerusalem, many of them former employees of a well-known Orthodox yeshiva network, yet the organization remains mysterious. The Forward cannot locate one of the group's board members. Another man listed as a board member said he had never heard of the charity. A third acknowledged he was on the board of the charity but claimed it had no relationship with Canary Mission, because they found a link. The same guy named Jonathan Bash, who runs Canary Mission, apparently also runs this other website. So they're looking anyway. It's as we speak. There's basically investigative pieces looking at this, and I'll link to these articles, but people can do their own research anyway. So the upshot is that yes, there's, and I guess I'm not sure if it was Los Angeles or San Francisco or both. I guess said that they're no longer gonna be funding Canary Mission, so I guess this has had some immediate effect. We don't know anything about Portland. I'm sure there's probably individual people, donors to this website as well. If anybody wants to look into any potential Portland connections, I'm not saying there are, I have no idea, but certainly there's some strong West Coast connections. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so, you know, Alana, you were talking about your kind of coming of age in the Black Lives Matter time, obviously the continuing sieges of Gaza, mm-hmm. and you're part of a younger generation that is much more strongly steeped in this intersectional mm-hmm. approach to politics, as you say, connecting the dots, I guess is another way of putting that. Mm-hmm. What I've heard over the past few years is that there's a lot of younger Jewish people are sort of breaking with sort of the political, ideological orthodoxy. It's never been obviously complete, because there's always been, Jewish people have always been involved, you know, in both pro-Palestinian work and many other social justice work. Mm-hmm. But it seems like there's a bit of a generational difference. I'd like first to hear from Ariel, who has a bit of a longer perspective, if you know your perspective on that, and then hear directly from Alana. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Ariel.
Yeah. Sorry. Let me pass this to Alana first.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Oh. Okay. Well, I think it's for a lot of reasons. Number one, young people are smart. My generation's very smart and quick to realize the connections of injustices, how things are connected. How, if you're anti-oppression, you must be anti-oppression for all people. That should be a given. But also, I think that with older generations, it's harder to critique the state of Israel, at least from what I've heard from older Jews. They feel like it's too soon, I guess, if that makes sense. Like, it's too... it directly affected their lives growing up with their grandparents or their parents, of people who were living in Israel, who made Aliyah or whatever, they have family there. But with younger Jews, I think it feels a little more, I'm not speaking for all of us, but for a lot of anti-Zionist American Jews, it feels disconnected in a way, where we feel far enough to critique it because we don't feel like we're a part of it, really. And I don't think that's a bad thing. Yeah, because that's the point, is that we exist in diaspora, and that's not our homeland. We have no ties there, so we're allowed to critique it and say, like, no, you can't speak for all of us, and that's not this horrible crime against humanity is not in the name of all Jews. That's like, how dare you do that, you know, in our name. We didn't sign off to that. And then on the other hand, also, I think a lot of young Jews are in this moral crisis of like just the state of the world. And with the Trump administration, Trump and Bibi being best friends, it's like it feels like a moral emergency for a lot of us. And so like that makes it also more urgent. And seeing like the Trump administration throughout the past few years and connecting it with Bibi and what he's been doing, it's been like a very...
That's the Saudi prince.
No, Bibi. Oh. Benjamin Netanyahu. Oh. I don't want to say his full name because it's ugly. Okay. Sorry, guys listening. I'm not a big fan of him. So a lot of young people are just making the connections between these two governments very, very quickly and realizing, oh, so I don't... Even people who were considered... They consider themselves liberal Zionists are waking up and saying, oh, so Trump... gives a lot of money to Jerusalem. Why did he move the embassy to Jerusalem? Why is he doing all these things that are inherently xenophobic and racist? So maybe what I was taught isn't true. And they're putting these clues together, which mm-hmm. I think is pretty amazing. So
let me, we're at about halfway through the hour. My name's Paul Rowland. You just heard Alana Goldman, who's the founder of a new Jewish Voice for Peace chapter at PSU. And I didn't actually ask you more about Jewish Voice for Peace. We haven't talked about the organization specifically. We'll do that in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And I'm also talking on the phone from New York with Ariel Gold, who's also with Jewish Voice for Peace, but more known as a national co-director of Code Pink, and someone who's confronted public figures such as Chelsea Clinton and others very publicly. I know that Code Pink does a lot of that. Medea Benjamin, certainly, you all were very present at the Kavanaugh hearings and many, many others. Code Pink always seems to be kind of on the forefront. Anyway, and you were also detained and deported from Israel, as you mentioned earlier, last July. Well, this is a call-in show, so we do welcome your calls and questions and comments to 503-231-8187. You're encouraged to not wait until the last 10 minutes of the show, which will just make it more difficult to get on. And so, 503-231-8187. Ariel, would you like to talk a little bit about that generational difference?
Yeah, well, I think this is a really exciting time in diaspora Judaism for us to be watching this shift among young Jews. We're really seeing, you know, this break that Alana was talking about with blind support for Israel. So many young Jews who have gone on these propaganda trips over the years and through generations, starting to really look for other narratives and see what's happening and starting to have and demand these conversations. And I would say this extends to having them within our own families as well. So I would argue that we're bringing in the older generations as well with that. I hadn't gone on any of these trips, and the first time that I went to Palestine and Israel was with a delegation to see the occupation. And like Alana, I was, you know, just horrified. There's something about seeing it firsthand. I myself hadn't been able to comprehend, even though I knew all the facts and the details, I wasn't able to comprehend beforehand how really terrible this is and what a violation of my values as a Jew. So I've been watching this shift among my own children. I have a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old who have been raised in traditional Jewish American community. And I've watched a lot of these spaces begin to open up among the conversations with their friends. So even this past summer when I was denied entry, my son was at his Jewish sleepaway camp as a, it's called Mahon, it really means junior counselor in training. And he heard about what happened and wrote an open letter in the foreword to the president of the Union for Reform Judaism, the denomination we belong to, and said, you know, I want to know what your position is on my mother being denied entry. And he's begun to have these conversations with his friends and with his community. And I think this is going to continue to open up more and more. And it's one of the bright spots that we have in this horrific time.
Well, we do have a couple callers. Let's go to our first caller. That's James. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. I actually have two questions. So the first question...
You're very, very distant sounding.
Hang on a second.
How about now?
Yes, and we encourage all our listeners not to be on speakerphone. Thank you very much.
No problem. Okay, so I have two questions. Number one, how much do you, and this is for both Ariel and for Alana, how often do you, or like to what extent do you deal with American Christian, like the evangelicals, because there's so many organizations that give money, that provide funds for I don't know if they call it repatriation or whatever fancy spiritual term they have for bringing Jews back to the homeland. But how much do you deal with them, and how much do you have to talk to any of your Jewish friends about their dealings? And because they support Zionism only to the point that once Jesus comes back, then, you know, they want all the Jews to go away, but they support the Jews up until that point, I guess. And the other question is, because I'm not a Jewish person myself, but I started studying Jewish literature because I was more interested in a more historical portrayal of Jesus and maybe what he believed, because he talked a lot about observing Torah. And I just want to know, how do Jewish people, I mean, given the extent of, you know, what Jewish law covers and how it's supposed to sensitize people to the world around them, how do they bridge that gap of apathy in order to be able to, you know, be able to just kind of turn a blind eye to what Israel's doing to the Palestinian people?
Okay, thank you, James.
Yeah, no problem. I can take my answers off the phone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ariel?
Well, I think Christian Zionism is something too far out there and absurd for, you know, rational people, rational, ethically minded people to speak to. It's really in alignment with the religious fanatical settler movement in Israel, and this, you know, idea that God gives land, or, you know, any of this is controlled by that. I have to say, I don't have any of those people in my life, and I try to focus my work and any talks I give or debates on those who are at least, you know, kind of rational, coming from a rational perspective.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say the same thing. It's the debates and conversations I have with people are with people who are willing to listen and change their minds maybe about something. And I don't think a lot of these people even really love the Jewish people or the Palestinian people. So I don't see the point of wasting my energy there.
But they are a political force to be reckoned with. And
yeah.
I wonder more how the, you know, the traditional conservative Jewish leadership that, say, invites Ehud Barak to the Middleman Jewish Community Center in Portland, or funds a Canary Mission or whatever, how they reconcile, it's sort of implicit in James' question, I think, how they reconcile to being strange bedfellows with these Christian Zionists.
Well, they'll take the money. They have, the thing is, they have money, and so a lot of Jewish federations will work with them because they, you know, they have the funds to get what they want. So that's more than, you know, I can say for our chapter or, follow the money. Where does the money go?
Fair enough. And let me see. I got to announce coming up on KBOO this morning at 9, Lisa Loving hosts The Radio Activist featuring grassroots movements near and far. At 10, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, The Food Show talks to the folks from Helios Farms about their community-supported raw milk dairy, plus deepening the roots of social struggle through food justice. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member and you haven't already, go to kbo.fm and click on donate. We've got Michael on the other line. Go ahead, Michael. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Can you hear me?
I said yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay, so I'm Jewish, and I am on the other side of this issue from your two guests, and there's one particular fact that hardly anyone knows that I think is very relevant, which is that when Israel fought its war of independence in 1948, there were approximately 700,000 Palestinian refugees caused by that war. And then in reaction to it, the Arab world basically went totally anti-Semitic, and there were approximately 700,000 Jewish refugees that had to leave the Arab world and come to Israel, the Sephardic Jews. So when they talk about the right of return, it turns out that, well, what the Jews did, what Israel did, was they absorbed their refugees and made them part of society. What the Arabs did was they kept the Palestinian refugees in these miserable refugee camps, and they ended up being, you know, a weapon against Israel by being trapped in those refugee camps, but it was the Arabs that did that to them, not the Israelis.
I can respond to that. I think what I try to focus on the most, especially right now, is the fact that Palestinians still are refugees. So we can say, like, well, because of this war, because of the Nakba, you said 1948, that happened, but Palestinians still can't go home. And so they wear a key around their neck of to represent, like, being displaced. A lot of Palestinian refugees haven't been back to their villages or their towns where they're from in Palestine. And so I think, like, I don't know, for me personally right now, I focus a lot on the right of return for Palestinians because I think it's important to recognize that a lot of people still can't go home and they still can't return back to the place they were displaced from. So, and well, that's today.
Yeah.
Well, the Jewish refugees can't go back home either. The Jewish refugees from those Arab countries, if they went home, they'd be slaughtered.
I'm happy to respond to that. So first of all, I just want to point out that there's a vibrant Jewish community in Iran who are quite happy there. You know, I think that we as people for whom human rights are important, want all refugees, whatever country they're arriving in, to be treated with full dignity and given safety and basic human needs, right? I think we as Americans are dealing with that issue right now, and as are Europeans. But the issue here that we're looking at is international law, and as a Jewish people, we have a long history of respect for law and for an international body. So international law is quite clear on this issue. Mm-hmm. International law says that Palestinians have the right to return to their homes and lands or receive compensation. And, you know, the question of Jews, Mizrahi Jews, Arabic Jews, if they did want to return to countries that they came from, that's a completely separate issue and doesn't have any bearing on what we're addressing here, which is the actions of the government of Israel to respect and implement international law in relation to Palestinian refugees.
Well, you can say that, but the symmetry between the two groups of refugees seems totally relevant to me, and the way they were treated in the places that they became refugees in seems totally relevant to me. And there's other ways of looking at it than the way that you look at it. And, you know, you're not going to make any progress with people on the other side unless you get into conversation with them. If all you do is try to turn Israel into the equivalent of apartheid South Africa, well, people are going to push back against that, and rightfully so.
Any response?
I do think it's definitely important to have those conversations, especially as a white Jewish person. I am willing to take on a lot of that labor to talk to other Jews who are on the fence or have questions about where I'm coming from. But at the same time, I'm a student. I work. I run a chapter. I have a lot going on, and I think sometimes it's unpaid labor for me to have conversations with a lot of people who don't want to change their minds. So, that's what I have to say.
I'm happy to respond to the addressing of the issue of apartheid. So within the actual state of Israel, there are over 50 laws of discrimination between Jews and Palestinian citizens of Israel. These laws apply to housing, to water, to education, and so much more. We recently saw in Israel the passing of the nation state law, which codified these discriminatory laws. That's only applying all of what I've just said to inside the state of Israel. Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza have been living under a 51-year-long military occupation. They don't have the rights, very simply, to vote on the power that controls pretty much every aspect of their lives. And I'm referring here to the Israeli military. And if you've spent time in the West Bank, like Alana and I have, you see that the military is everywhere. And I know for myself that this is so out of alignment with my Jewish values and the history that I'm proud of as a Jew for supporting equality, freedom, and dignity for all people.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michael, for calling.
Let me leave you with one last thought. Ariel Sharon conducted an experiment in the early 2000s. He gave Gaza back to the Palestinians. Every Israeli settlement was uprooted and pulled out of there. Gaza ended up Judenrein. There were no Jews anywhere in Gaza. And a Palestinian could have, you know, that's beachfront property on the Mediterranean. They could have made a paradise out of Gaza. And instead, the first thing they did was the Israelis had left behind these high-tech greenhouses that grew tomatoes. And they left them behind. The Palestinians could have taken them over and, had themselves a business there. And what the Palestinians immediately did was, apparently out of spite, they destroyed those greenhouses just because they had been built by Jews. There were no Jews in Gaza. If Gaza didn't keep mounting attacks against Israel, Israel wouldn't be blockading
them. Thank you. Thank you, Michael, for calling. Ariel, would you like to respond to that last point?
Sure. So Gaza, we can again go back to international law here, and Gaza is under the definition of international law of the United Nations, still an occupied territory. Israel controls Gaza by land, air, and sea. It controls all entry and exits. This is the largest open-air prison on earth. There was one point where Israel announced publicly that they were controlling the number of calories that were able to go into Gaza as a tactic for tormenting the people of Gaza in order to try to control the population. So I could go on and on about Gaza, but suffice to say that.
Okay, well, thank you. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland. You just heard Ariel Gold, National Co-Director of Code Pink, and I also have, she's on the phone, I have Ilana Goldman, founder of a new Jewish Voice for Peace chapter at Portland State University, where she studies. The title of this show was Israel and Saudi Arabia, Two Bullies of the Middle East. I kind of figured we would really be focusing on Israel, partly because Amy Goodman just covered what's going on in Saudi Arabia very extensively, a lot of history, also a lot. She asked a question about the ties between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which I wanted to talk about. Not that everyone listened to that show prior, but I figured we'd be a good opportunity to sort of get into a lot of these issues about sort of the younger generation represented by Alana and their attitude towards these questions. And it's good that Michael called in because we had that conversation. I know that when we were at the Middleman Jewish Community Center on Sunday, there was a lot of people driving in, some people giving us the finger, some people looking angry, maybe a little bit of support, not much, but there wasn't people walking in, so there wasn't any opportunity, and nobody did come out to talk to us. It might have been a little intimidating. There's a lot of people with signs and chanting and such, but so there weren't any opportunities for conversations there. I'm sure these kind of conversations do happen within families or not, as the case may be. Anyway, it's good that we're talking about it here, and we've got someone calling in. We've got Roz. Go ahead. You're on the air.
It's my mom.
Okay.
Hi. Good morning. I am Ilana's mom.
Oh.
And so, yeah, I have a little bit of a question for Ariel and a perspective from my generation, that if I didn't have children who were all activists and, you know, involved in that way, I probably would feel like most of these Jewish Americans. I wasn't educated on any of it. I didn't really think about it. I raised my kids in the conservative temple, sent them to Jewish sleepaway camp, you know. And so, excuse me. And so I didn't know. And so now, you know, of course, with my daughter, I listen and I educate myself and I understand a whole lot more than I did and support her and all of her views. What is scary to me is, as a parent, that I think we live in a crazy society, and I worry about that someone will hurt her.
So, don't laugh. That's a legitimate worry.
Sorry, it's just funny that you're calling.
But it's true that, like, you know, you speak out like this, and then the next thing you know, people are threatening you, or, you know, you're blacklisted, you know, right, in Israel on this website and whatever. And I worry. Mm-hmm. And so the question is really for Ariel, I guess, like, as a mother, you know, how do you not worry?
Mm-hmm. You know, I should begin by saying my children have undergone some bullying for my own positions, and because I am a well-known figure speaking out against Israel. And, you know, it's been in some ways a tough road for them. But this is our community, and this is our future. And I know for myself that someday I want them to be able to tell their children what we did as a family, and what their mother did in this time when our people were committing crimes against humanity. And, you know, we live in a dangerous time overall, right? We have school shootings and so much to be afraid of. And I think that, and Ilana probably can speak to this, you know, really strongly as a JVP chapter leader, that it's through solidarity that we have real safety, rather than through hiding our values or through militarization, that we really have to get to places of safety through solidarity and through shared values. In terms of blacklists and being denied right, entry into Israel, again, it's by coming together that I think we have any chance to defeat this. And, you know, uh-huh, we're watching right now with the American student who's being denied entry and detained. We're watching mainstream organizations like the ADL come out in her defense. And so uh-huh, we have to find those places and support each other and build the community and the world that we want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say that you you must have done something, you know, so many wonderful things with your daughter that she came out as such a strong advocate.
Oh, thank you. All three of my children are that way. So, in different aspects, different, but the same views, the same motivation and, you know, courage to go out and speak their minds. And I just, like I said, it's not even so much just the Jewish part, it's just the society in general that I worry. Of course, I'm proud of them and want them to do that on one hand, and on the other, I just like lose sleep thinking, you know, that some crazy person who doesn't agree with them will hurt them.
Well, thank you for calling Alana's mother. Appreciate that.
Icon, we love you.
Okay. We've got only about 8 minutes left, and so we're going to move on to another caller. I had a conversation with Alana in you know, preparing for this show where, you know, I had a sign that said, Mittelman supports genocide. And, you know, I'm not a Jewish person, so, you know, it's not... You know, may not even be my place to make such a statement. I guess my feeling is things are just going so bad that it feels to me like, you know, we're potentially living, you know, under something that, you know, these analogies with Nazism, with fascism may be a little easy to make, but I mean, it's there to see. I mean, we had, you know, there's a Yale professor just wrote a book about how fascism works. I think he was on Democracy Now!, the 10 pillars of fascism. I mean, you look at the checklist of things that are happening that are actually similar. So yeah, it's not a time to remain silent. I mean, it seems to me like what Alana was saying, what Ariel was saying, it's a, perhaps to me as a non-Jew, it seems to me that Jewish people looking to their history of oppression and identifying with other oppressed people and being in solidarity, as you said, Alana, the only thing I can see is some kind of coalition of people getting together to fight what's happening that we've seemed to be unable to do because of identity differences, because of cultural differences, because of political differences. We got to get over this stuff. Anyway, that's my little soapbox. Mitch, go ahead real quick. We got about 4 minutes left.
It's really hard to be quick on something so complicated, but let me just start by saying thank you for giving voice to two members of the Jewish community. I'm a member of the Jewish community, but the distinction is almost microscopic that I remain a Zionist and yet recognize the blacklisting that is going on against many of my friends who are Jewish are anti-Zionist. So I don't want to waste 4 minutes discussing the distinctions between the two, simply to say that blacklisting affects everybody. It affects you if you're American and not Jewish and want to speak up against Washington's policies, but in America it's especially pernicious because I happen to feel there are understandable reasons why Jewish anti-Zionists would have been suppressed for so many years in their viewpoints. It's just that if you're like me, interested in Israeli society and have relatives in Israel and remain engaged, you know that the Israeli left up until 1977 would have been further left than today's anti-Zionists. And their positions were principled. It's just that they've been written out of history, but with the help of the American Jewish community, because no one wants to see this. So I'm thinking about your caller, Paul, who called in and was questioning, because he's a Christian, about the close alliances between Christian fundamentalists and your two guests, Ilana and the other guest there also, I'm forgetting
Ariel.
Her name, and Ariel mentioned that they want to stick on the rational side, which is a position I've taken too. But what he triggered in me was that very few Americans, because of the media blackout in the United States on Jews that take anti-Zionist or even critical positions of Israeli policy, are blacked out. There's no room for this kind of discussion. I would send people to YouTube and watch Angels in America. You can't watch the whole thing for free. You'd have to pay for that. That's the Tony Kushner play. But Al Pacino's depiction of Roy Cohen, an American Jew who who back in the...
Okay, Mitch, I got to cut you off because we have literally a minute left, and I want to give Ariel and Alana quick last words. But thank you for calling in and making those points. We really appreciate it. Ariel, give us some final thoughts before we let you go.
Sure. Well, this past summer, we launched a new campaign. We're targeting Israel's largest weapons company called Elbit Systems, which is involved in all of the major assaults that happen on Gaza, surveillance on the apartheid wall, as well as surveillance at the U.S.-Mexico border. And people can learn more by going to codepink.org/stopElbit. That's E-L-B-I-T.
E-L-B-I-T. Yeah, we didn't get into the nitty-gritty of the BDS campaign and others. My bad. Alana.
Last words. I guess for anyone, I guess this is directed towards students, but because I'm a student, get involved if you feel helpless in this administration or in this world right now. Join an organization, get involved, even if it's just messaging one person. That person, I'm sure, will be willing to help you and guide you into an organization or a campaign or something that morally aligns with where you think this world should be. And that also includes other issues that align with the issue that you mostly care about. So, like, find something you deeply... I mean, everyone should deeply care about Palestine, but join an organization if you feel like... if you feel as strong about this as we do.
And, of course, you're with the Portland... I mean, the PSU chapter, but there's a broader Portland chapter.
There's also a Portland Jewish Voice for Peace, and they're awesome.
And I linked to that organization on kbo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Rowland. Thank you, Alana. Thank you, Ariel.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we got to get out of here. Stay tuned for Hazel Lovely.